Hello and welcome to 251, two pianists, five podcasts, one subject. And this is the second episode of our series looking at the piano player Kenny Drew. Last time we looked at the Kenny Drew album, Introducing Kenny Drew, which was his first album as leader. And this week we're going to go on to look at his contribution to the Chet Baker album, It Could Happen to You, Chet Baker Sings. My name's Nick Tomlin.
And I'm Simon Whiteside. So Kenny Drew, as we said in the first episode, was born in New York, but he did spend some time going over to the West Coast, which Nick is going to talk about in a moment. I'd just like to say a few things about the episodes this time round. We've been lucky enough that our podcast aggregator is now going to be on Audible and Amazon, so that's another way of people getting our stream. And we'd be really great if you could let us know what you think about the podcast and maybe tell us what you'd like to hear more about, whether you'd like to hear more musical examples or you'd like to hear more biographical detail or more general stories. You can probably, the best way to do that is through our Facebook page. We have a page for this podcast and I'll put a link in the show notes so you can comment there. But of course, if you could leave us comments and reviews on all the main podcast platforms that you, whichever one you use, that'd be fantastic. So Nick, handing over to you to talk about a bit about his life before the album.
Yeah, we left Kenny Drew in 1953, having just recorded his first trio album under his own name. And about this time, he moved to the West Coast and he stayed there for about 3 years, although obviously he was kind of moving around a bit as well. While he was there, he played with some notable West Coast musicians, including Buddy DeFranco, Zoot Sims, and also Dexter Gordon, which is quite interesting because obviously he went on to play with Dexter Gordon a lot more later on in his career. This was during Dexter's kind of sort of fallow period of the 50s, where he was struggling with a heroin habit and he sort of dropped out of the scene a little bit. But they recorded a really good album called Daddy Plays the Horn, and that was the first recording that Kenny Drew actually did with Dexter Gordon. He also played with Sonny Chris, and he released some albums under his own name with a quartet with Joe Maney and Jack Sheldon, Leroy Vinegar and Lawrence Marable. So they're all kind of West Coast musicians. Again, at some point in 53, he was arrested on a heroin charge. There isn't much information about this really. And I think it's unlikely he went to prison because by July 1954, he was recording with Zoot Sims. He was in the studio, so probably served little, if any, time in prison. Yeah, I don't know if you've got any other thoughts about this period of his career, Simon.
Well, the only thing I'm thinking, all those names that you mentioned, they're almost exactly the same people that Sonny Clark had played with. And in fact, they even handed over. Kenny Drew was playing with Buddy DeFranco, mm-hmm. with Art Blakey on drums, wasn't he? And both of those players left at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that's when Bobby White joined Gene Wright, and of course, Sonny Clark kind of took over in that band. So I think, and then of course, Lawrence Marable, there was that album with the tenor player and that Sonny Clark did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a lot of these names are very interchangeable. And of course, there were, you know, we have a view of the way the music worked there, but in a way, it was quite a small number of people doing quite a lot of the work, I think, in terms of recording anyway. There's probably more jazz recordings made in Britain last year than there were in the 50s in Los Angeles in some respects. And by that I don't mean that they're necessarily good ones, but you know, just lots of people now can record. In those days it was much more about contracts and not so much the ability to do the cottage industry sort of recording, small studio stuff that is now available. But I suppose the other really interesting thing is that when he did end up coming back to New York, it was with Dinah Washington, which is exactly the same thing that Sonny Clark did after Kenny Drew handed him that chair as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of parallel, isn't it, really, there? Their careers almost at this point.
So we're going to talk about the album It Could Happen to You. Now, because there are a lot of short tracks on this album, we thought what we'd do is break them up into some groups so we can talk about them a little bit more fluently. And in many respects, it's obviously Chet Baker's album, so there's a lot of Chet Baker on it and not as many solos. It's not like a trio album, obviously, so there aren't as many solos by Kenny Drew, but the ones that we have transcribed, obviously, we can go into some detail. So here we go.
It Could Happen to You, Chet Baker sings, was recorded in August 1958 in New York City and released by Riverside label a bit later that same year in October 1958. And it's the third of the Chet Baker Sings series. Chet Baker really started as a trumpet player, but by this point in his career, he was becoming as well known, if not better known, as a singer. But this was really the first album where he only recorded vocal tracks. I mean, he plays trumpet as well on this album, but some of the tracks are only vocal with some scatting as well. And we're going to look at the first four tunes from this album in this section. So that's Do It the Hard Way, I'm Old Fashioned, You're Driving Me Crazy, and It Could Happen to You.
It's definitely one of my favourite albums, and it's one of those weird ones where I hadn't really clocked I was listening to Kenny Drew. Obviously, it's a Chet Baker album, and the star of the album in that respect is Chet Baker. He plays really well on this album as an accompanist, and he plays quite differently, I think, to the trio album. I think singers like this album a lot because the scat soloing is very clear and concise and very melodic. And for me, there are kind of three significant scat singers from this period. Obviously, Louis Armstrong, who sort of invented it, Ella Fitzgerald, and Chet Baker fits into that for me because there's quite a lot of scat soloing that is not really soloing, if that makes sense. It's not covering the changes. But I think all those three people are really soloing as if they were horn players.
I might add Sarah Vaughan to that list, although I guess she was probably a bit later, wasn't she? She was 50s, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, Sarah Vaughan also, perhaps. But it's that, I mean, Cab Calloway did a lot of scat singing, but it was not cogent in terms of the chords, I would say.
No, it was more an effect, wasn't it? Like a sort of, yeah. I mean, I think Chet's singing style kind of divides people a little bit. I mean, I think it's fair to say he doesn't have a kind of traditional classical singing technique by any stretch, you know. And in fact, I read quite a good quote. The American critic Jim Hoberman, he said that listening to Chet Baker sing was like being sweet talked by the void, which I thought was quite a good description, really, in a way, of his style. But I mean, I love his singing, and I know a lot of other musicians who really love his singing. And I think I really like the way that his trumpet playing and his singing kind of inhabit the same sort of world, don't they? They're very similar. He uses very little vibrato on his trumpet, and with his singing, again, it's very kind of direct and flat almost, isn't it, his delivery, you know, but yeah. Very intimate. I think that's the thing. You really feel like he's there kind of talking to you, you know.
It's definitely a whispering voice rather than a shouting voice.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And I think that you wouldn't be able to hear him without a microphone. And I think he probably sang very close to the microphone and very quietly. He doesn't seem to be exerting much effort in a way. He's not putting a lot of air through his diaphragm for the singing. And I think you're right. His trumpet tone is also quite fragile and wispy. But he's very accurate. And it's difficult to know for sure with these players how well they know harmony, etc. But he had a fantastic ear, and he always makes the changes.
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard stories that he didn't read music at all, and I think I saw an interview with Russ Freeman where he said that he would just give Chet the first note of a tune, and Chet would kind of, you know, use that as his reference point. And but whether that's true, but then I've also seen him writing the piece in manuscript, so I don't know. I don't know if that was just a kind of photo, photo. But I'm not sure. But as you said, his playing is beautiful and melodic, and he's always always makes the changes, and he knows where he is, and you know.
Although to be, I mean, some of these changes are more complex, but he does often choose kind of 1-6-2-5 type chord progressions. I'll just maybe illustrate that. So if you're going round 1-6-2-5, that's chord 1, chord 6, chord 2, and chord 5. Is the most obvious version of that. And he does often have, you know, he doesn't have tunes that go into, I wonder what he would be like playing an original by someone, you know, bringing something into the studio. But we should go on to talk about the tunes here. Do It the Hard Way is the tune that you've transcribed a solo from. So perhaps we should not really talk about that in too much detail now, but just to say that it's from Pal Joey, and which was a 1940s show, both stage and made into a film. Frank Sinatra, I think, starred in a film of it. And we'll come back to that one, shall we, to talk about
it? Yeah, sure.
And the second tune is an interesting one. It's one of the longest ones on the album. In fact, probably the longest take on the album is I'm Old Fashioned. Have you got any background on that for us?
Well, it was written by Johnny Mercer and Jerome Kern, 1942. It was written for a film, You Were Never Lovelier. And in the film it was performed by, it was Rita Hayworth and Fred Astaire. They do a kind of a duet in the film. But I think it's also interesting because he performed this on Blue Train, which was recorded just slightly before this album, the Blue Train album, but they play this tune as well. Although it was kind of, by this time, I think it was quite a well-established standard, I'm Old Fashioned.
Yeah, I don't think Rita Hayworth actually sang it.
I think it was dubbed. Yeah.
But it is from that film, and I love Johnny Mercer's lyrics. He was really one of the top craftsmen, and he really adds, it's poetry, isn't it? He really adds fantastic poetic images around his lyrics. And of course, he was quite a young guy at that point. He was working with quite a mature composer, so I think that was quite a thing for him. You know, he was really chuffed to be almost fathered. You know, it's like a mentorship. I mean, the tune itself's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not quite a traditional form. It's almost like A B A A rather than A A B A in the way it's structured, and it has that middle section starts in the home key, doesn't it? Which is unusual.
Yeah,
And then wanders off,
kind of ascends through.
Yeah, some quite
keys.
Complex.
Yeah,
some quite sort of. That's the only bit of the tune that's complex. The rest of it is exactly how I was talking about, you know, the 1-6-2-5 stuff.
Yeah.
But that bit sort of really wanders off into a totally different key and then comes back.
Which I think is why jazz players kind of like it, really. It's quite challenging, that section, isn't it, to play?
Yeah. Or it's the bit you leave out a bit. Leave some notes out in that bit. I think, again, what Kenny Drew brings to this is the comping, isn't it?
Again, I mean, similar to Sonny Clark in a way that he's obviously a really he's a really listening player. He's trying to kind of respond to what's happening in the rest of the band, and he really adds another dimension to the performance. I think his comping.
And one of the things I noticed about the choice of tunes is that there are some older tunes. For example, "You're Driving Me Crazy" is a 1930 tune, but there are also quite a lot of tunes from more recent, so you know, 10 years or so before the recordings, whereas nearly all jazz standards, that ones that haven't become standards because people wrote them, if you like, but you know, jazz players wrote their own heads and the like, but they tended to be the Berlins and the Gershwins, didn't they, the 20s fodder.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting, maybe, and in, also in a sort of sense of trying to be more popular, that they were choosing tunes that might be more in people's
sort of
recent
current
memory.
Yeah.
And less, I suppose, vehicles of jazz that have been taken away from their original simplicity and added to for more complex stuff. I mean, You're Driving Me Crazy, that's by Walter Donaldson. I really like that tune. It's not one I I think it, the first time I heard it was on this album.
Mm. I think it was sort of popularised by Louis Armstrong, wasn't it? But I think he probably did the first performance of it and popularised it sort of a bit earlier.
Yeah, yeah. I think he definitely did with his one of his hot fives or sevens.
Mm.
But where I came to it was through this album.
Mm.
And the, well, interesting, there's a Betty Boop version of it. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that.
There's a cartoon version of it quite early on, I think the year it was written. And it's quite a seductive sort of, you know, her dress keeps falling down her shoulder. Sort of.
It used to do that sort of most of the time, didn't it? I think it was sort of
it was a feature. It's been a heavily covered tune, hasn't it, as well?
Yeah, yeah.
But what I really like in this one with Kenny Drew is that sort of rising thing that he does. It's hard to explain. One of the things I should have said in the introduction was that we highly recommend you listen to these albums before listening to us talk about them, because listening to them afterwards is going to be less educational, I think, than listening to them before and having them in your mind's memory. Have you got any other thoughts on his playing on this?
No, I mean, it's quite bluesy. Obviously, it's a kind of bluesy tune, isn't it? So he really kind of, he uses it as a way of using this kind of blues vocabulary, which is, as we talked about, is really part of his style, I think, anyway.
Mm. He plays lots of riff-based solos on these. On these. We'll talk about them in more detail when we get going. But maybe we should just have a very quick think about It Could Happen to You, which is the title track. So it's another popular standard, isn't it? This time by Van Heusen and Johnny Burke. But again, 1943, which it was in, again, a film. So there's quite a lot of links with film soundtracks on this album. The Angels Sing, and The Angels Sing, I think it was called, actually, in 1944, it was made popular. And there's a recording by Joe Stafford, I think, in 1943 that came out on Capitol Records. So it may have been a song that was incorporated into a film as opposed to a song that was in a film, if that makes sense. And again, it's got some interesting changes, this one, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a song which jazz musicians kind of like to play, and it's a really interesting tune. Yeah, and this is kind of quite an iconic version of it, really. And particularly his scat solo is it's a great scat solo, this one. And I think it's one that people tend to learn, isn't it? Because it's very sort of very melodic, you know, very expressive, and it's great solo.
Yeah, but it does actually have a diminished lick in it, doesn't it? Which is interesting, and I think singers do like the fact that it's singable, but also has some
interesting corners
more advanced harmony techniques. And of course it's also the changes that Dexter Gordon wrote his composition Fried Bananas on, which, you know, I'm sure at some point Kenny Drew and him will have played it together. It was quite a sort of calling card of Dexter, wasn't it, that particular tune?
It's interesting as well. Chet Baker sings this over the very last cadence. He sings this kind of descending line, doesn't he? Which I think is almost a little kind of, not cliche, but it's a little bit of vocabulary that, like, he does it again on later, I think, on Everything Happens to Me, and Kenny Drew kind of echoes it. So he's probably heard him do it before. So he kind of he follows him with this little. It's a really nice little descending.
Yeah, the very last
line,
phrase.
The very last phrase he sings, basically.
Well, we should talk about Do It the Hard Way, because that's the one that you have taken down. Would you like to take us through it?
Yeah, so as you said, I mean, this is from Pal Joey, and I wonder if Kenny Drew kind of suggested this to Chet Baker, just because he'd just recorded it quite recently, in 57, in fact, he'd recorded it. And it's not a particularly well-known tune, and other than this version, I don't really know of any other versions other than people actually doing tribute to Chet Baker singing it, really.
I think it was on both the Pal Joey Trio albums, the Andre Previn one and the Kenny Drew one from
right,
the year
okay.
before.
Yes, right.
But that didn't popularise it. I think in the show notes here, liner notes, does point out that he's done a lot to popularise this tune. which I think, you know, that's true today as it was in 1958.
Yeah. So, yeah, I transcribed the solo. He takes one chorus on this, basically. But it's a really, really nice solo. And his playing on this album is slightly different from, you know, comparing it to the album we looked at last time, which was much more beboppy and kind of driving his playing. On this, probably because, you know, they're playing standards. Most of them are kind of relaxed tempo. His playing is more melodic and kind of laid back, really. And he, in this one in particular, it's almost like a little masterclass in kind of melodic development. So melodic development, this is the idea in improvisation where you take a melodic phrase, you take a small phrase, and then you develop it. So you, I mean, it happens in composition as well, where a composer will use a phrase and then develop that phrase. It's one of the main devices, really. So Kenny sort of starts the solo with this little, quite simple little descending phrase. Simon, could you possibly give us a flavour
of it? So it's just a...
Yeah, that's basically it. It's going down from A flat, G and F, and he kind of bounces off the E natural. And then what he does is he then develops that phrase, sort of makes it a bit longer, adds some stuff to it. And then he comes back to that phrase and plays it again, but the second time it's slightly different and he develops it in a slightly different way. And then he comes back to it again in sort of bar nine, and he again plays it slightly differently and then develops it and then moves on. So he's kind of taking this little, I sometimes think of it as like a little germ of an idea, really, which he's keeps coming back to and elaborating on, really. So maybe if I play the first section, the first sort of 12 bars of this solo, just so you can hear what I mean.
And one of the things we noticed with Sonny Clark's playing was his ability to take a phrase and really develop it. I would say on this album, Kenny Drew is the developments are not that extensive, are they? They're kind of more looking at it from a different angle, as opposed to mutating it in some respect, moving it into a new area, perhaps, which Sonny Clark was doing in his mature playing. And then the other thing I noticed about it was that in that very final section where we get that sort of phrase in thirds, he's basically sort of quoting from the tune, isn't he? And almost sort of setting us up to come back in with the voice that's going to enter again. Do you have any more to add? Or?
No, I think that's all I was going to say, really, on that.
That concludes our first section, and we'll go on to talk about, in fact, three tunes next, I think. So we're going to talk about the next three tunes. In fact, it's the last track of the first side on the original vinyl, and then the first two tracks on side two. My Heart Stood Still is the first one, and then The More I See You and Everything Happens to Me. My Heart Stood Still is a tune that I've taken down the solo on. It's probably one of the more extensive, just like the one you did, Nick. It's probably the second longest solo on the album. He gets quite a lot of half choruses, doesn't he, and small amounts, as you do in these sorts of situations. So My Heart Stood Still is a 1927 song Richard Rodgers wrote, and Lorenz Hart wrote the lyrics, the famous Rodgers and Hart combination. And it was written for Charles Cochrane Review, One Damn Thing After Another, which was actually written in for a review in London, the London Pavilion. And the interesting thing about it is that there's a story about how it came about. They'd gone on a trip to France on holiday, or sort of a jaunt, and they'd taken a couple of lady friends with them. And they almost had an accident. A lorry almost crashed into their car. And one of their female companions said, "Oh, my heart stood still." And Hart said, "All right, I'm going to write that down. We're going to write a tune on that." But we won't talk about that much now because we've got some detail to go into. The next tune on the album is The More I See You. Have you got any information on that, Nick?
Well, this is written by Warren and Gordon, songwriting team, 1945, for a film. And it's another film tune, this film called Diamond Horseshoe, which I don't really know much about other than it was called Diamond Horseshoe. I think the song was sung by Dick Hames in that film.
Yeah, I think you're right there. In 1944, I think that was the peak output of the Hollywood studio system. Mm-hmm. They made more films in that year than there were days in the year to watch them. That's not including all the short films. That's the actual feature films. It was an absolute bumper period. And a lot of these studios had their style. So you'd have Warner Brothers was known for its sort of hard-boiled fiction Fox was more known for its epics, and you know they all did bits and pieces. But it's interesting how lots of these songs on this album come from films from that period. So it's quite possible that you know they're either romantic or crime film noir type crime was very popular. Diamond Horseshoe doesn't sound like a potentially dark one, but there was a film called The Glass Key, which doesn't sound particularly dangerous, but was a film noir, for example. It's a good tune, though, isn't it? It sounds very much like it's come from a romantic movie, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. And again, it's one of these which was written as a ballad, but tends to get interpreted, well, very often as a kind of swing, or I mean, it's played in different ways, but it's not always played as a ballad, is it, this tune?
But there was a version of it, I think it was a 60s version of it, that was used for an advert a few years back, which is almost like a, well, it's not Latin really, it's more kind of like that 60s sound, you know, the Beatles sound with the sort of ride cymbal ting 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 ting, no, straight eights on the ride cymbal, and it's a little bit of a Latin. I've heard a very good Latin version of the more.
Yeah, sometimes it gets done as a Latin tune.
It does go off into some interesting keys, doesn't it? That sort of minor bit in the middle is quite...
It kind of modulates around a bit and moves around a bit, doesn't it?
But again, I think, you know, with Chet Baker, he's quite happy to go to a new key as long as it goes there, if you see what I mean. You know, that seems to be his favoured tunes that he likes to play and sing on. These ones that go to places and stay there for a bit and then move back to where you started or whatever. Do you have any thoughts on Kenny's playing on this, or should we move on to Everything Happens to Me?
Yeah, I think let's move on to the next tune.
One of the things that is going to happen a few times in this series is we're going to talk about a tune on one album and it's going to turn up on the next album. So, for example, our next episode is going to be about Blue Train, isn't it? So we've already got a crossover there from this album. And Everything Happens to Me was on his trio album, wasn't it? It's a song that Frank Sinatra made. We talked about Frank Sinatra making it famous originally with Tommy Dorsey, and that was a big hit for them. But the interesting thing for me about Chet Baker's version is that he gets the irony, I think, much more. It's kind of an ironic... All these bad things happened to me, and the last bad thing to happen was that I fell in love with you. And that's a very... It's quite hard to pull off that, I think.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, yeah.
So the original Sinatra version, he sings it, you know, like as a crooner. He sings it, you know, it's almost a sad song for him. Whereas Chet Baker, I think he sings it with a twinkle in his eye, if you could see them, which you can't on a record. Again, lots of nice comping from Kenny Drew and some really nice voicings, some really nice chord voicings.
Yeah, he kind of reharmonizes, you know, occasionally in places. And it's a really nice performance from Kenny Drew on this.
It's definitely one that I like singing when I do my sort of piano and voice gigs. In fact, I sing nearly all of the stuff off this album in one guise or another. It's just a really, really fun song to sing. And if anyone's actually listening, which is rare on jazz gigs, as we know, especially the wallpaper gigs, as we call them. Yeah, that you do see people's reaction to that last line being, oh, I get it now. I get why this guy's... But there are some absolute classic lines in there, aren't there? Like, I never miss a thing. I've had the measles and the mumps.
Yeah, I heard there's a recording of Billie Holiday rehearsing this song, and she introduces some interesting swear words into it, which I probably won't actually go.
We'll have to check it out.
Yeah,
it's explicit.
It's quite funny. The X-rated version of this song.
Well, then let's go back to "My Heart Stood Still." This is a very riff-based, again, very riff-based solo from Kenny. The other thing is that it's Philly Joe Jones, I think, on this track. And when he goes into his solo, Philly Joe Jones immediately picks up on the kind of groovy, funky... Because Kenny Drew is going to be one of the funky pianists, isn't he? And it's sort of coming through now. And he really starts hitting that fourth beat hard with a rim shot.
Yeah.
It kicks the song along.
Yeah, and I mean Kenny he just repeats the first phrase sort of. Yeah,
it's basically Now's the Time, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I think, like you say, he kind of responds to Philly Joe, kind of sets the groove, and then he just repeats that same phrase, and it sounds really good, but he just repeats, it's just this one little phrase which he repeats sort of four times, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in fact, when I was and this is the thing I found, I think you found it too with Kenny Drew, is that you've said four times. But he always throws you. So he, in fact, repeats it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times. Five,
yes, that's true, yeah.
And then once he's done it the fifth time, he takes it out with a little blues thing.
Yeah.
Before going into a lot more bebop-y stuff. And then he can't help himself. He goes into double time and really bebops the hell out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible... I mean, that section of kind of double time... semiquavers, you know, is phenomenal, really, isn't it? I mean, so fluent, really.
Well, I've transcribed those, and I fully admit I was unable to do that at full speed. So I had to use one of the transcribe-type apps where you can slow it down and have a listen. And in fact, what's so amazing about his technique is that they're really crisp, those semiquavers.
Yeah.
But when you slow them down, you can hear that there is latitude in his playing. But obviously, if you're slowing it down to 50%, there's latitude in everybody's playing. But yeah, it really—it's real like gunshot, isn't it? It's like Gatling gun, you know, really going for it. And then after that long section, he sort of realizes he's doing a popular album, sort of calms down a bit, and takes us out in a really groovy fashion again. So, and in fact, he has this. That sort of thing. Again, so he comes back to his really sort of...
Funky,
yeah, stating we're in F and there's a lot of F. This F6. Which fit, you know, that those sixths, the sixth root and fifth really fit pretty much on anything, the 2-5-1 that you want to use, don't they? Have you got any thoughts on the solo?
No, other than it's a great solo, considering it's quite short. I mean, all his solos on this really are quite... I mean, it's one chorus, isn't it, he does on this?
This is one of the longer ones,
too. It's one of the longer ones,
Like the first track.
Yeah. But he, you know, it's a great solo, and particularly that semiquaver section is... it's quite remarkable, really.
Well, let's finish off there, then, and... we'll then talk about the final three tunes in brief.
So we're going to talk about the last three tracks on the original album, Dancing on the Ceiling, How Long Has This Been Going On, and Old Devil Moon. So Dancing on the Ceiling, this is one of the tracks where Chet doesn't actually play any trumpet. He just purely sings this. He sings a whole... scat chorus on this before Kenny takes a short solo. This is a Rodgers and Hart tune. I think you know a little bit more about the actual details of this tune, Simon.
Yeah, so yeah, as you said, it's a 1930 Rodgers and Hart tune, and it was for a London musical called Evergreen, and it was sung by Jesse Matthews in that. And it was originally part of another musical called Simple Simon, but it was cut from that production before the premiere. There was a film version of Evergreen, and Dancing on the Ceiling was again sung by Jesse Matthews, the same person. But interestingly, and this is why I mentioned that it was a London show, the earliest popular recording of it, even in the USA, was by the Jack Hilton Orchestra, the British dance band, effectively. In fact, really what it is the BBC House Dance Orchestra. It's a lovely tune, isn't it? And it's got a sort of really interesting image of... I think it's she's a ballet dancer in the
Something like that
in the film.
Yes, yeah, and he can hear her sort of dancing,
and
upstairs.
He's sort of bothered by it, but not bothered by it.
Yeah, it's a nice concept. Yeah,
and it's got it's one of those tunes that sort of doesn't really get out of its home key, does it much?
No.
It reminds me of a tune, say like Blue Moon, where you go 1-6-2-5, 1-6-2-5, and then on the bridge you go 2-5.
Yeah,
you know, you sort of, it's the same set of changes, but you start from a different point, and it kind of gives it a slight difference, but it is in fact never really moving too far away. And Kenny solo on this again, he uses very much little lick that he's been using a lot throughout the whole thing, that almost
repeating
the time
to, yeah,
with a little bit of quoting of the tune to and make sure everyone knows where they are, I guess, and also to make it... I think that method, I mean, although it's something he did use on, for example, on the solo I took down on Stella, he does refer to the tune quite a lot in his solo before going off on bebop sort of interludes. And then he kind of brings us back in with a little bluesy vibe. And at the very end of the tune, he also takes us out with a quite long, extended blues lick, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Before landing on the end chord. Have you got any other thoughts on that one, or do we
no?
Talk about?
I think let's move on. So the next tune. How long has this been going on? This is written by the Gershwin brothers, so Ira and George Gershwin, 1927. So it's a bit earlier, this tune, and it was originally written for a review called Smarty, which I think somehow later became Funny Face, which was actually made into a film. Quite a bit later in the 1950s, starring Audrey Hepburn. I think she actually sings it in the film version, doesn't she?
She does, Funny Face.
There's one thing that always kind of bothers me about this performance. Chet kind of sings, well, he either sings the wrong words or he's deliberately changed the words. I don't know if you've noticed this, Simon. So there's in the original lyrics, in the last verse, he sings, "Kiss me once, and then once more, what a dunce I was before," which rhymes nicely. Well, Chet, for some reason, keeps singing "Kiss me once and then again, what a dunce I was before," which always I don't know, it kind of annoys me because it doesn't rhyme. I don't know whether, but he does it both times. So
I think he's just misremembered it.
He misremembered it.
Or that's how he's decided to. I mean, I don't think you unleash your voice on the world, do you, Nick, so much as I do, but you do sometimes get these little brain freezes where you know what the sentiment of the song is, but maybe you forget the exact words. One of my favourite versions of this is the incredible Ella Fitzgerald with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. One of those books, songbooks. It's a fantastic version that she does. This song didn't really stick in anything because they did write a show called Funny Face that they wanted to put it in, and it didn't even get used in that originally. It first appeared in 1928 in a show called Rosalie, and Ira Gershwin being another one of the great lyricists, but he was one more of the Cole Porter style with the cunning pun. Just a little bit of the verse here, which I'd like to quote, which is absolutely brilliant. "As a tot, when I trotted in little velvet panties, I was kissed by my sisters, my cousins, and my aunties. Sad to tell, it was hell, an inferno worse than Dante's." Absolutely classic. Mm, mm. I don't think little velvet panties mean the same thing as they back in the 20s. I think that meant trousers.
Yeah, I hope it does.
In the sense of Americans, pants now mean trousers.
Yeah.
Any more to say on that, or should we talk about Old Devil Moon?
No, I think let's move on. Let's move on to Old Devil Moon.
Yes, well, this is one of my favourite lyricists on this, not because I like particularly their work, but just their name's brilliant. So Old Devil Moon is a popular song composed by Burton Lane, a very common and well-known great songwriter, but the lyrics are by Yip Harburg.
Hmm.
That's a great name.
It is a great name.
And again, this was from another film, the musical Finian's Rainbow, which was in 1947. In fact, it was Fred Astaire's last feature film. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
And in the film, it's introduced by Ella Logan and Donald Richards. They'd done it in a Broadway show in the 40s. But the film was made in 1968, actually. And in this version, it's actually sung by Don Franks and Petula Clark.
Hmm.
But there's another really great version of this that I like with Mel Torme and the Marty Page Dectet, which I've also transcribed in the dim and distant past. But what Kenny gets basically a small amount of the it's quite a weird format, isn't it? This tune,
it's an unusual form.
It goes back to this Latin-y bit quite a lot. And Kenny, really, when he comes in, he's almost like one of those big band interludes, isn't it? You know, where he's sort of going.
Yeah, it's kind of block chords.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he goes out of that, when it goes into swing, we have another one of his repeated licks, but this time he adapts it to the harmony. Fit the change from the B-flat major to the...
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a nice little false... little extra 2-5-1 that we talked about in the tune Gloria, didn't we? That sort of sidestepped.
So it's
I suppose in a way it's quite a good one to finish on, because it's a précis of his technique throughout this album, which is to use these very hooky riffs. And it makes it a very approachable album, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of that. The solos are not the type of solo that a non-jazz player, non-jazz listener would say, oh, those are really, they're just playing for themselves.
Solos. No.
Don't understand any of this. It's very understandable.
Yeah.
Very catchy, very groovy, very dancey, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, you know, we found this with Sonny Clarke as well, how happy these players were to sort of adapt to their, you know, to the situation. And they weren't sort of saying, this is what I do, like it or lump it. You know, they were really trying to kind of, you know, fit in with what was going on around them and I suppose really just contributing the best to the music, you know, that they could. That's my sort of feeling about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think both players, I mean, they have, there's some amazing parallels, aren't there, between their careers. I'm not sure if Sonny Clarke, I think he did record with Chet Baker, didn't he? One of his earliest albums on the West Coast.
Yes, when he was on the West Coast, yes. Yeah.
Was with Chet Baker. But I don't think Chet Baker was singing at that point.
No, it was just instrumental, I think.
Well, I think that probably brings us to the end. We'll just have a short break and then wrap up.
Okay, so that about wraps up our look at the Chet Baker album, It Could Happen to You. Chet Baker sings, featuring Kenny Drew on piano. Just a couple of things we need to mention. We have a Patreon page. All of the transcriptions we've been talking about, and we've even been demonstrating sections from, they're all on our Patreon page. And for a reasonable donation a month, or you could just make a one-off donation and then cancel it, you can get access to all of these transcriptions, and they're all kind of original transcriptions that we've done, so you don't really find these in any books or anywhere else. And also, I think it would greatly enhance your experience of listening to these if you have listened to the playlists that we're putting up on the Facebook page. We'll probably link to those as well in the show notes to this episode. Have I forgotten anything, Simon? I probably have.
No, I think everything's good there. The look out for us turning up hopefully on Audible and Amazon Podcasts. That'll be a new area where we haven't yet appeared, but we're on all the main podcast apps, the Apple, Spotify, and anything you listen to podcasts on, we're going to probably be on there, unless it's a dedicated player like the BBC Sounds. We're obviously not going to be on something like that, but do leave comments. We'd really like to hear from people as to what they would like us to do, because we do these shows once every fortnight, so there's time for us to take into account what people say. So leave us a comment on the Facebook page, click the link in the show notes, and just leave us a comment, and you know, good or bad, we're grown-ups, we can take criticism, and of course we'll then send the boys around. Anyway, from me, Simon Whiteside, goodbye.
And from me, Nick Tomlin, goodbye.